This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world.
Would you join me in an attitude of prayer, please? Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. As we gather here this morning, our hopes are that the detritus of this week, the flotsam and jetsam of time, will wash on by past us. We commune together in this hour in hopes that we may draw closer to that which is the essence of life. That essence at times seems erratic and fleeting. Let us settle into this moment. Breathing deep into our bellies, let the anxieties of life be lifted up with our breath and exhaled into the world at large. Our foundation, the place that's firm and unmoving, that place is nowhere outside of us. Going inside now as we are, we feel that the cosmos is reflected in the darkness of our inner being. The moment that we are told is fleeting, that moment upon which we ride like the second hand of the clock, once inside the evanescent moment, that moment evaporates and we come face to face with eternity, which is now and now and again now. We are the world, the universe, the cosmos experiencing itself. Our consciousness is the mirror upon which time seemingly flies. Yet the mirror remains constant, and letting our minds go blank, we finally understand that we are nothing more than that mirror, and also nothing less. No image sticks to a mirror. Fear, anger, anticipation, expectation, anxiety, these we finally see as ghosts in that mirror. Thinking we see them brings life to them again, and so we let go. We relax, and in that relaxation, we finally see that even who we think we are is a ghost in that mirror. There is freedom in that disappearance. The past, the present, the future, all right here, right now. Knowing that there is no true reflection of who we are, we accept all reflections and hold on to none. That which once scared us is nothing more than that which once scared us. That which brought us joy, simply that which brought us joy. Not pushing away or resisting, not holding on or clinging, we awake. The inner world, the outer world, the same, and we are the swinging door of our breath that connects them both. In the name of everything that is holy and that is precisely everything, amen. I have one reading for today, and it's from Wendell Berry, the essayist, poet, and novelist. It's called The Peace of Wild Things. When despair for the world grows in me and I awake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wooddrake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water. And I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting with their light, For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. In the Gospel, according to the good doctor Luke, Jesus says in part of the narrative about him, "Do not worry about your life, what you will eat, or your body, what you will wear." I can tell by looking around this congregation that you've obviously heeded Jesus' fashion statement. For life is more than food, and the body more than raiment. Jesus goes on, "Consider the ravens. They do not sow or reap. They have no storeroom or barn, yet God feeds them." In other words, they don't make a whole lot of plans, but the natural cycle of life supplies them with their needs. Who of us, by worrying, can add a single hour to their life? Since we cannot do this very little thing, why do we worry about the rest? We're given similar messages in many religious traditions. There's the Zen story of the two monks, one old, one young, traveling between monasteries. They come to a stream which is swollen from the rain, and there's a geisha there she can't cross. The old monk reaches down and ties up his robe. The geisha jumps on his back, and he escorts her across. About 3 miles from the stream, the young man can't stand it any longer, and he shouts to the older monk, "I can't believe you actually touched that woman." The older monk stops, looks at the younger monk, pats him on the shoulder, and says, "You really must be tired. I carried her across the stream, but you've been carrying her ever since." Being in the moment allows us to let go of the past. Being in the moment allows us to let go of the past. Still, we are Westerners, and we have a built-in desire to improve our life and our surroundings and our world. How can things be perfect as they are in this moment? How can we look upon the journey of life and not be concerned about reaching the destination? For if we are for peace in the world, then we must be concerned with when and how peace will arrive, right? If we wish to abolish the death penalty, then we had better be prepared to work long and hard in a society that does not believe in restorative justice to help bring about the end of vindictive punishments. In his book, Lateral Thinking, Edward de Bono suggests that we in the Western world are concerned mainly with product and goals. Once we've decided what that goal is, we put the pedal to the metal and we go toward the goal and we don't look left or right. De Bono suggests that it's this sort of practicality that's gotten the Western world into so much trouble. Well, when we race toward our goal, we don't look down the alleyways. We're blind to the detours and the side paths. With our eyes on the prize, everything else dwindles in the background, and we become obsessed with the end product. What was it we used to kid and scorn the communists with? You remember, Marxist philosophy suggests as we approach the transition from the exploitation of the capitalist worker and begin the rise of the proletariat, between that exploitation and true communism, what is it that the Marxists say? The end will justify the means. Hasn't there been something in the papers and news recently about the torture of terrorists? That the information from those terrorists is so important that we'll go to any length to get that information, even if it means torturing them, even if it means getting information that's bogus? The end, it seems, again, will justify the means. Lateral thinking suggests that what looks like a goal in the beginning of an inquiry may in fact not be the goal once we have begun the process of inquiry. How does this come about? It comes about because as we pay attention on a moment-to-moment basis, we do discover the alleyways and side paths of life. And in those alleyways and side paths, we discover meanings that we never knew existed. Those meanings change us, they change our goals, rendering the original goal obsolete and its attainment unnecessary. Two of the most famous Civil War generals, who were both Confederates, Major General Thomas Jonathan Jackson and General Robert Edward Lee, commander of the Army of Northern Virginia, both held on to their roles in the Civil War up until the very last moments of their lives. after Stonewall Jackson had been mortally wounded by his own troops, friendly fire, at Chancellorsville, and moved to the railway spur at Guinea Station. His arm was amputated, but he seemed to be recovering. Then a fever set in, and after having said goodbye to his wife, Anna Morrison Jackson, and his daughter, Julia, that he named after his mother, he lapsed into a fevered sleep. At about 3 p.m., he woke up from that sleep, and he called out, "Order A.P. Hill to prepare for action. Pass the infantry to the front. Tell Major Hawks." Well, he left that last sentence unfinished. And in the midst of the Civil War on May the 10th, 1863, he ended his life by saying these words, "Let us cross over the river and rest under the shade of the trees." Robert Edward Lee survived the Civil War and became president of Washington College, which now bears his name, Washington and Lee, in Lexington, Virginia. He was struck down by the heart disease that had pursued him since Gettysburg. But bizarrely enough, his last words also ordered A.P. Hill into battle. "Tell Hill he must come up," Lee said, before letting go of the battle and ending his life with a soldier's eulogy. His last words were simply, "Strike the tent." Death had taken both men back to their previous goals, the winning of the war between the states, and yet in the end, when death made its final claim, both generals, obsessed as they had been with the Confederate victory, both generals let go of that struggle and ordered themselves a rest. Now, this next will give you an inclination of how I think. This reminds me of Caddyshack, the movie. Bill Murray is the main character in Caddyshack, and he tells the story of a summer in which he was the attendant for the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And at the end of that month, all the attendants got together, and they were displaying the huge amounts of money which each of them got, but Bill Murray got nothing, so he explains to the other, "Well, the Dalai Lama pulled me aside and told me that for my services that summer, I would receive complete full enlightenment on my deathbed. So, I got that going for me." The point is to live life so that we don't have to find the solution to our woes on our deathbed. I mean, it wouldn't be terrible to become enlightened on our deathbed, but it should be obvious that it would be nice to become enlightened before the door slams in your face. There's a Zen Buddhist saying which says, "Look under your feet." You're looking for enlightenment? Look under your feet. There was an Air Force pilot shot down in Vietnam who spent many years in a prisoner of war camp. He lost 80 pounds and most of his health. When he was finally released, he told his buddies the first thing he wanted to do was play a round of golf. Well, they got him dressed. They took him to the golf course, and between themselves, they thought he'd be lucky to make 9 holes. But he played all 18, and much to their surprise, he played a superb game and beat every one of them. When questioned about his play, he admitted that during his imprisonment, he had played 18 holes of golf every day. He played on courses he knew well from memory, but eventually he became bored with those, and he designed newer, better courses that would challenge his ability and sharpen his game. This Air Force pilot is a perfect example of someone who looked under his feet for the treasure. Unable to do anything inside a confined space, not offered much food or distraction, this Air Force pilot decided that his feet were not bare, that on his feet he had golf spikes, that there wasn't a bamboo wall in front of him, but a fairway 400 yards long. There are those who say that one must be born into a family that will teach one to be this ingenious in trying situations. Or if not that, one must be born with the right genes to be able to do this. It's true. Children who have parents who set boundaries are interested in what their children do, regardless of whether that reflects well on the parents or not. Children who feel as if they have choices in life, including the choice to disobey their parents. Children who are able to commit to what they're doing unselfconsciously, and who feel challenged with increasingly complex opportunities for action, these children tend to be those who are able to cope with whatever life gives them. Obviously, the Air Force pilot was probably one of these lucky children. Yet even if we weren't raised in such a family, and who of us were, And even if we don't think we've got the genes, it is possible to learn to be a person in flow. A person who sees a challenge not as a threat, but as an opportunity for learning and action. A person who is in flow is a person whose consciousness is not disordered. This type of person moves easily through life, knowing that whatever is presented to it can be incorporated into its consciousness, and those things which are not helpful will simply be discarded. And when this person hears voices, the voices are all encouraging and congratulatory. The battle to remain in flow, to remain in the moment, is not a battle between the world and oneself. It is rather a battle for control over our own consciousness. There's a Buddhist saying, and it's true, but it's complicated. Listen to this. The fool sees himself in others, while the wise man sees others in himself. There's a difference, you see. A fool projects his fears and prejudices upon those around him, while a wise person is able to see the foibles of others within himself. There's two obstacles to remaining in flow. One is anomie, and the other is alienation. We all know what alienation is. What is anomie? It's basically a lack of rules, no boundaries. If there's one thing that I'm learning in this interim preaching experience, after being here a year as the intern, it's the fact that I must reestablish my personal boundaries. What's lacking when we feel there's no boundaries is a lack of propriety. And it's Wendell Berry, the poet and essayist, once again, who says, "The idea of propriety makes an issue of the fittingness of our conduct to our place and circumstance, even to our hopes. It acknowledges the always pressing realities of context and of influence. We cannot speak or act or live out of context. Our life inescapably affects others, which inescapably affect our lives. We are being measured, in other words, by a standard that we did not make and cannot destroy." You get that last one? We are being measured, in other words, by a standard that we did not make and we cannot destroy. There is a sense in which propriety is the opposite of individuality, but a self in flow, a person who's conscious, can do seemingly contradictory things at the same time. When we're in flow, we tend to stick out from the rest of the crowd because the crowd does not know what is proper and is basically alienated from their own lives. That's why the crowd looks to the crowd to see what the crowd wants. That's why being in a large crowd is dangerous. Yet this tendency of a person in flow to differentiate themselves, to define themselves from the crowd and stand out as unique, is counterbalanced by those people's ability in flow to feel in union with others and others' ideas. A leader, in other words, is a person who defines themselves and yet stays in contact with those they are leading. The second obstacle to staying in flow is alienation. Karl Marx knew what he was talking about when he said that would be one of the major problems of an industrialized world. In alienation, it's a social problem. We're constrained by society to do things against our own happiness and our own goals. The constraint is usually economic. We do a job not because we want to do a job, but because we get the money and we've grown used to being fed and dry. And who on a day like today cannot think of those people who cannot do this and are homeless? Alienation has all kinds of effects, but the one I see today that's the most horrible is the one that leads people to the point of killing without thinking about what they're doing. Children in our society are taught to play video games in which they obliterate the blips of the enemy, and they win when they are not killed and the enemy is decimated. Believe me when I tell you, it's a short jump from this sort of computer warfare to the Gulf War, smart bombs, and the war of Iraqi freedom. In the film, The Ground Truth, which was shown here last Monday night in this very sanctuary, digitalized computer images of a group of people were shown walking down a street in Iraq. These images were grainy and broken up, and you couldn't tell. Was it women? Was it children? Was it goats? You couldn't tell who these people were. But the radio accompanying, the audio accompanying these images simply reported the movement, and it was relayed back that the movement was to be terminated. "Roger that," came a voice, and then the voice said, 10 seconds to impact. 10 seconds later, a horrific explosion, and the images were obliterated. Were they women? Were they children? Were they goats? There's a disconnect here, a disconnect between pushing a button and total annihilation. Those were more than blips and digitalized images on a screen. Those were sentient beings. The story I'm about to tell you in conclusion was told to me in parts and pieces over many a drunken evening. Over 30 years ago, I heard the story from my father. He could only talk about his experiences in the war when he was drunk. And I figured, why not get drunk with him? His sober mind had put his experiences out of reach, tucked them away, buried them. This is my father's story. Before I was shot down, I flew 7 combat missions. I always thought 7 was a lucky number, you know. 7 come 11. 7 come 8 would have been all right with me. I was shot down, didn't bail out, rode the plane down. Nobody was killed. One guy lost an eye, but I kept both of mine. So still kind of lucky. Not a whole lot to do with your eyes in a prisoner of war camp. Watch the guards, watch you. So I read a lot. The Bible mostly. My dad's Bible. He had given it to me the day I left the war. Left for the war. He was sitting on the porch, sort of lying back on the porch in Bluefield, West Virginia, the way he always did, a lemonade in one hand, his Bible resting on the seat. He closed the Bible, got up, gave me a hug, and kissed me right on the lips. Couldn't remember the last time he'd done that. "Bring that back to me," he said as he tucked it in my B4 bag. "Your mother gave that to me, and if I lose it, she'll raise hell." I carried it in my navigation bag, didn't have any intention of reading it, really just thought it would be good luck to carry. As you can see, I didn't lose it. Pop had these pieces of paper, little corners of paper, stuck in special places. There were 2 numbers on each piece, chapter and verse, chapter and verse. This is the one from Proverbs. "These 7 things doth the Lord hate, yea, 7 are an abomination unto him." I guess 7 had never been the Lord's lucky number either. "A proud look, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood." Sorry, I can't get past that part. I never can get any further. It's okay, really. I know I did what I had to do, right? I mean, I made the world safe for democracy. But whose world am I talking about? I mean, how many worlds are there? How about their world? You know, them. The enemy. Oh, yeah, sure. They're just targets, blips on the screen. But just because you put yourself miles above them in a B-17, and even though they appear like ants, people are still people. And those abominations, my God, those abominations, they tore those people to shreds. They burned them alive. I didn't even know those people. I could never, ever have done that in person. And all I did was push a button. Push a button. I guess sooner or later we all get our buttons pushed. But that's not the end of it. Oh, no, if you're with the aircraft, and you are, because you're flying it with the bomb sight. And if you follow the bomb down, you do, because it's simply follow through. Then you're there when the bombs flash out. That's the thing about technology. It gives you an illusion of separation, but you can never be separated from what you started. Never, ever push a button, pull a trigger. You release a part of yourself, the projectile, the armament. It's you. Otherwise, you couldn't hit squat. It's when that idea hits home, you realize how destructive intention can be. The best, the worst, makes no difference. Paving stones to hell. Part of you has gone out, done what it will do, that part never returns. Ever. In conclusion, I'd like you to stop thinking that what you're doing now is preparing for something else. Don't buy into that retirement illusion. The way you are now is the way you will be then. As my wife, Viv, is fond of saying, wherever you go, you take your head with you. In the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, this is it. The way you treat the least of these is the way you will be treated. In the words of a John Lennon song, instant karma is going to get you, going to knock you right on the head. You better get yourself together. Pretty soon you're going to be dead. What in the world you thinking of? Laughing in the face of love.